welcome back to another Co-op the Cast. This is Co-op the Cast, episode number 86 for April the 23rd, 2012. We've got a fine array of gentlemen here tonight. We've got Locke, we've got Mike, we've got Jason, and we've got myself, Nick. How's everybody doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Grand.
Today was the second day I got home from work on time, so that was awesome.
You are working like a dog.
They are working me like a dog, sir.
That's crazy.
I hope they're paying you money.
Does Monopoly money count?
They're paying him Microsoft Space Bucks.
Nice.
That's what it feels like sometimes, and those Microsoft Space Bucks go straight into Mass Effect for Spectre Packs.
They're sponsoring his Spectre Pack habit.
That's right.
Locke needs your job.
Yeah.
Yes. So I've definitely moved on from the Mass Effect gross habit, and proudly will say, managed to make it through that game without purchasing anything but the DLC.
Nice. Well, so what else have you been playing then, Locke, if you moved on from Mass Effect 3?
Seriously, I went from the Mass Effect 3 to the Warriors of Orochi. Now, I fell into this Fez coma, and I was like, my eyes were glazed over for 2 weeks, just being like, oh man. And Fez is really interesting, and I was really glad that I played not only the sort of first part of the game, which I'm sure everyone who's played Fez knows about. You know, you can platform around. It's a puzzle platformer where you hop around. You turn the screen. It's a really cool mechanic, and I think it's very novel, and it suits the game very well. But then after you finish the game, and you play again, that's when the real game starts. That's when the real puzzle starts. And the platforming and the screen rotating becomes secondary to the mind freak puzzles that Phil Fish has come up with. It is crazy how, I don't know, how much of a rabbit hole you kind of delve into and just witness how... witness sort of his mind and how it works. He's created this, you know, this number system and this language system and all this whole little world that has a cool backstory where you do have to infer some stuff. But it's one of the, it's one of the only games that I've ever busted out a pen and paper in this generation. I don't even know if I've done that since like Myst. So in order to solve some of the puzzles, and It's really about exploring and immersing yourself in this world, and it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful game that I think everyone needs to play. I don't think everyone's going to get the same reaction and sort of feeling out of it, but that's okay. I think that's okay. A lot of people that go into this game and hop around and be like, oh, that's cool. You collect cubes, you hop around, you turn the screen and put it down, probably won't be satisfied with their purchase. And I would encourage you, those of you who have done that and haven't picked it up again after you finish the game and get sort of the quote-unquote end game achievement, the kill screen, if you will, pick it up again and try and explore the world, because there's some really cool stuff that you get to witness after that.
So if you get all of the anti-cubes, does Phil Fish's digitized head pop up and say, fuck Japan?
Yes. He actually burns a Japanese flag in front of you.
You know, the oddest experience I have with that game is after playing it and doing the same thing, just diving down the rabbit hole, as I went to work the next day, and I'd have a conversation with my coworkers, and then I'd just start slowly rotating myself around them.
That's awesome.
They just didn't know what was going on. I'd be like, what's going on over here?
Okay, what's going on over here? I'm just so happy with the game, and maybe I'm sort of giving it an extra pass just because it's exactly what I wanted out of this. I'm a sucker for this sort of pretentious artsy game. You know, we've had stuff like Braid, we've had stuff like Journey.
You say, did Braid put you in a sugar coma?
Yeah, like Braid was cool, and I'm a sucker for that. And some people don't dig on that. They're like, well, what the hell? Where's the story? What does this mean? And I'm okay having a story that's ambiguous, and you know, that's happened in other games like Eco and Shadow of the Colossus, and those are some of my favorite games because they're willing to take a chance and they do something novel, and they're very interesting in their ambiguity. So that's why I really enjoy them.
That's interesting to hear. Like, you know, some of the writing and stuff I've been doing with
with Kat on Blue Shit Alliance and like writing some of the levels and the dialogue and stuff. Like, she's the kind of person where she wants to explain and have a reason for every little thing that's in the game. And I'm like, well, you don't have to. Like, you know, at one part we have these ships carrying generators. And she's like, well, where'd they get the generators from? I'm like, I don't know. Who cares?
Doesn't matter.
Right? It doesn't matter. Let the player make it up.
Walk right, shoot guys.
To some people that, you know, that really bugs them and it rubs them the wrong way. And to other people, it's like, I'd rather use my imagination. Who cares where it comes from?
Yeah.
I loved the crap out of Braid until I heard Jonathan Blow open his big fat mouth.
That's exactly how I felt too. And that latest article from
The Atlantic.
Yeah, The Atlantic
mass self-masturbatory, aren't we great because we're auteurs?
Yeah, it's a thing
about
Braid is a great game and it's a lot of fun and it does some cool things, but you don't have to crap on what everybody else likes just because you think you're that much better. Like, that's what it comes down to.
But
yeah, because Gears of War is a great fucking game. Braid is a great fucking game, but just because Braid has pretensions of being something better than just a game doesn't mean that all other games are shit compared to it.
Yeah. Right.
Which is basically Jonathan Blow's stance.
Yeah.
There was a really interesting article that Jeremy Parrish over at 1UP wrote once Fez was released, kind of touching upon this, of how the games world is starting to approach that level that, you know, other media like music and film is, in terms of the developers, the people who actually create the games that we play, are now having an impact on the way we perceive the games and the way we, you know, it used to just be you played Super Mario, you used to play these games, and who cares, right? It's just something to enjoy. And now the people behind it actually have a face, have something to do with the way that we enjoy that experience, which I thought was rather interesting.
I will just point out that Sid Meier had a very name-driven impact on my childhood. I don't think that's necessarily a new thing.
Yeah. Well,
I think it was a thing, and then went away, and now it's come back.
But the fact that it was Sid Meier, you didn't know, though, Sid Meier, in terms of him coming out and saying, I think American is the greatest development nation in the world. Like, that sort of personality from the developer themselves, you just had a name. I mean, people knew Miyamoto, they knew, like, he made those games. Now they actually have, someone to match up with that, and him speaking publicly and having his views expressed.
So the fact that Yuji Horii is a known racist means I can't enjoy Dragon Quest now?
That's a valid question that's, raised, is that it does that impact the way that you look at Dragon Quest?
Yeah, that's someone associated with Dragon Quest. I forget if it was actually Yuji Horii, but...
Like having that name association does two things. It allows you to, you know what to expect out of that developer or that producer. And then, do you go on and allow it to, have an impact on your experience? Because I would say that even if the name is in the title, like Phil Fish's Fez, I would still evaluate that game based on it, in and of itself as an identity. And maybe that's me tricking myself not to bring in those extra connotations of it.
Right.
But
it's just a branding thing. It's just, Jason was saying about, like, movies and stuff like that. Like, even though you don't have Michael Bay's name in the title of his action movies, he's created a brand of action movies. And you know what it is. Yeah, you hear his name, you know the type of movie you're going to get. And it's the same way with Tom Clancy games, Sid Meier games, whatever. You know what that name means, and whether it's a real person or it's a brand,
Oh yeah, and people, I think people are searching for a little more meaning in that. Like, certainly, if you're the type of person that directly connects a person's, say their personal politics. To me, this goes back to Orson Scott Card being involved in Shadow Complex.
Right.
And how he's, like, super anti-gay and a crazy Mormon weirdo. And sorry for alienating our Mormon audience. But, there were a lot of people that were like, I'm going to boycott Shadow Complex because Orson Scott Card had a hand in it. And, like, you're throwing out this entire game that's made by, probably 99% other people than Orson Scott Card.
Yeah,
just because you don't like him. And Shadow Complex was a fantastic game.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
and I just don't get it. I think an artist's personal politics can stand aside of the work they make.
Yeah,
and just you know, Orson Scott Card is got like crazy politics, but Ender's Game is one of the best sci-fi novels I've ever read.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know, and knowing what he feels about things didn't change. Like, I went back and read it recently, and it didn't color it in any different way.
It's not like you're looking for these, you know, these Latter-day Saints undertones incepted into everything.
It's
although I did wonder why in the third act Ender was always wearing a suit and tie. But, you know, that's...
Well, it's like everyone that, you know, watched Lost, you know, they wanted to find some deeper meaning in every single thing. And not everything actually meant something. It was just a bunch of, like, random MacGuffins and BS.
Yeah.
But nowadays, everyone has to find, like, oh, well, there must, like... You know, Trials HD had that crazy puzzle that was in it, and it was just in the end, it turned out to be a bunch of wank. They threw it in there because they knew people would see it and go crazy searching for it, even though there wasn't really an answer.
And I love it. I love that.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's a game, but, people. But like, take it for what it is.
Something like that isn't present, and people will go searching for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to bring it back to Nick's sort of comment, being like, it's a game. You have full, you know, I don't like the word, but you have full artistic sort of control of that. You can do whatever you want, and people don't need everything to be answered, because that's your prerogative to be like, hey, this is here, take it for what it's worth. And I think that's part of the experience, especially to go back to Fez. I think that's part of the experience to be like, the last puzzle in Fez, the one that everyone's heard of or hasn't heard of, the monolith puzzle that got basically brute force hacked to find the solution. Nobody knows what the real solution is. I kind of hope that nobody finds that out, or it never gets revealed, because it'll be this sort of mysterious thing that, who knows, maybe Phil Fish was fucking with everybody and just threw that in there for shits and giggles. And I think that's hilarious. That's kind of a cool sort of statement on a game, and being like, yeah, I did that. And, you know, it makes for a cool discussion. But
I mean, I hold up as example Metal Gear Solid 2 as the greatest example of a developer just screwing with his fan base.
Yeah. Yeah.
And why not? Like, people take games too seriously. So
I think games can be taken seriously, but I think sometimes people take them too seriously.
That's what I mean. Like, I think games should and can be taken seriously, but in the end, they're still games. We play them for, you know, enjoyment.
I entertain myself with this medium, therefore I must search for a deeper meaning in it, so I can validate myself instead of realizing I'm stuck in the basement.
Yeah, there's self-validation, you know, in every hobby, right? I mean, that's kind of why you do a lot of those things.
I don't know. Like, it's funny you brought up Lost. Like, it was really fun to speculate about the different sort of iconography and symbols in Lost, just because it was fun. Yeah. It was a really cool thing. And I didn't, at the end of the day, I didn't really care if those were, you know, those riddles were solved, but there are people that really gave a shit and were pissed off because it was like, oh my God, you didn't answer that. And that goes across any medium.
We're kind of going off.
I never tried to theorize about stuff like that. One of my hobbies was going to the darkest pits of the internet and finding the most crackpot craziest theories.
Just like,
I would never think of this. You're actually insane.
Well, yeah, you know, we're kind of going off track here, but what was interesting with Lost is like what happened on the internet, if you listen to their podcast, influenced the show, actually. Like, some That's of the awesome. Crazy crackpot theories, like, they started, like, reading this stuff, and then they actually started implementing some of this stuff. So they basically, like, validated everything that these people wanted in the show. They were like, well, we might as well do it. You know, they were kind of doing the work for them.
I think that's genius.
So it's kind of interesting. But
anyways, yeah, to finalize my discussion, buy Fez, play it. It's quite the great gaming experience.
Okay, so let's move on. How about Jason? What have you been playing?
Fez.
Let's go back into that.
No. Cutting your mic.
I haven't been playing Fez, but it was the open beta weekend, obviously, this weekend for Diablo 3. So I hopped back into that to play with a bunch of friends, since that was their first time getting into the game, and had a lot of fun. It confirms the reason why I think we all fall in love and play that game is the co-op, because having played a lot of it by myself through the closed beta and just testing things out and seeing what they were going with, it was nothing compared to once actually I had you know, a large group of friends who were finally playing the game and being able to play with them. And them seeing all this stuff for the first time and reacting to it was really cool. Particularly our friend Todd, and playing through with him and him figuring some of the mechanics out and being like, and at one point he typed something to me in party chat and been like, so about, and then he sent, and like that was it, it paused. And then the dialogue continued. He's like, never mind, that entered it. Like, I mean, you know, seeing those things that had the same reaction was really kind of a fun experience.
That's coming out sort of soon, isn't it?
Like 2.5 weeks.
That's crazy. That's absolutely nuts.
But you know what? Diablo. My 9800 and 9600 GT cards still make that game look pretty, so...
I heard Cub Ninja was running it on his laptop, so...
Yeah. Just got the integrated Intel thing, so...
I think it'd be awesome if you had, like, an entry-level machine, if it just reskinned it as Diablo 2. Like, everything just became sprite-based.
And I'm assuming we're all getting aboard that train. I don't know. Nick, have you played the beta?
Yeah, I was in the beta, yes. The closed beta before, so...
So I think I'm the only one here who hasn't played Diablo 3. I am...
And I signed up to review it.
How does that make you feel, Locke? I mean,
oh, great! I'm
sad and empty
inside.
No,
it just makes me excited. Being like,
is there a black monolith in your heart?
No, it makes me excited because I kind of know what to expect because it's Diablo. But then, since I haven't even touched the game or paid attention to anything but like the classes, like it's going to be a cool, fresh experience, and it's going to make me feel like. When I went and played Diablo 2 and, you know, you sit in your room for 3 days straight and just explore this cool gothic world. So, yeah. No, I'm definitely stoked for it.
Cool.
Mike, what have you been playing?
I haven't been playing too much, but I jumped on the free-to-play bandwagon.
Nice.
And so I started by playing Tribes Ascend because I played the crap out of Tribes 2 back in the day. It was one of the staples of my college dorm experience. And I went to school in the same town that the developer was based in, so a lot of the students were basically their beta testers. And the dean of the school's son worked for them, so it was pretty fun. And so I played Tribes Ascend, and it feels... It captures a lot of what made Tribes great, but it feels...
Which is what? What is that?
It's just... Have you played Tribes before?
I have, but some people don't know. Some people don't know what makes Tribes great.
What makes Tribes a little different is that...
Like,
it's
shit,
really
it looks like Halo
things.
For all I care.
It's like you're flying around on jetpacks, and you can turn off your... Like, you can... In the old days, you were exploiting mechanics in the game to, like, ski down hills and gain speed and jump off. And they've kind of embraced the whole thing. Like, you can make yourself frictionless, so you'll jetpack, then drop down the side of a hill, turn off the friction, and you're basically, like, ski jumping around. The Tribe experience, if you've played Quake 3, there's that one map that is nothing but jump pads.
Okay.
And everyone's flying through the air, and you all have rocket launchers. And it's really hard to hit people because you're all flying through the air at thousands of miles an hour.
Nice.
And that's kind of what Tribes is like, except there's vehicles and capture points. And
it's big and open.
Yeah,
it's huge. It's huge and open. I feel like Tribes Ascend does a really good job of recapturing what made Tribes really fun, but I can't shake the fact that it feels like an Unreal Tournament mod.
Okay.
It feels a lot like if you played Unreal Tournament 3, you know how, like, the mouse works in a first person Unreal game.
Yeah.
And it's really fluid and it's really fast. But there was this, like, you felt a little more ponderous in real Tribes than you're really agile and you're spinning your mouse around, and you're aiming everywhere and flying all around the map, and it just feels a little too fast to me.
Okay.
I think it's really fun, and it does the free to play model really well, in that you can unlock basically everything just by putting hours in, and you're dropping a little bit of money to, you know, unlock the stuff you want. Like you'll find that you want to play as this class, and you don't want to spend the next 30 days trying to unlock stuff. So you might drop you might drop $5 or $10 to get some boost. Right. To,
and have you put any money into the game yet?
I have not, because I tend to want to see if I stick with a game like that before I put money into it. Like, I've tossed a few random bucks at like Team Fortress, because I've probably played like 30 or 40 hours of it, but you know, I played a lot of Team Fortress before I ever, you know, put money in that Steam wallet.
Yeah.
So Tribes is good. It's, you know, definitely check it out, and you can't beat free. No. The production values are pretty high quality for a free-to-play game, and it's, you know, I think the content is a little lacking. There aren't as many maps as I'd like, and, you know, it's kind of limited on modes at this point, but
it's, you know, early.
Check it out. I definitely recommend it. And the other game I've been playing was Super Monday Night Combat, which is, you know, also free to play. And I had actually never played the original Monday Night Combat.
What?
So I didn't really. Yeah, I know. I didn't know what I was. I knew kind of what I was getting into. I knew it was kind of like a weird, not quite tower defense game,
like it's,
mashed
it's,
up with
yeah.
Team Fortress type stuff.
Tower MOBA.
Yeah, basically. but it's pretty fun. It gives, again, it's a free to play game, so there's a lot of options to spend money to give yourself perks and unlocks, but you can again earn it all through, you know, through playing. And
if you had to choose one of
the only thing I wish
these...
about that game is if they were going to have announcers running the entire time, that they did not limit the amount of stuff they can say to about 5 things.
He's heating up.
I played like 3 matches, and I probably heard the "What's the purpose of the robots in the arena?" you know, pre-recorded message about 100 times.
Yeah.
But it's really fun. It's, you know, it's got a hell of a lot of personality. I personally enjoyed playing as the giant ape man and rolling exploding barrels into groups of guys, and then going on a homicidal, like, fist pounding rampage.
Nice.
It's pretty fun. I think I recommend it a little more than Tribes, just because I felt it, like, I dug what it was doing a little bit more. But you should definitely check both of them out if you have an appetite for some competitive first person shooting.
Yeah.
Cool.
I played a little bit of Monday Night Combat. I really like how they separated the classes. There's 5 different sort of archetypes, and then within those you can pick several different heroes that play very differently. So I thought that was cool. I looked at the stuff you can spend money on, like, well, gold, experience, and cosmetic items, and I see myself putting some money into that game, just because I played the hell out of the first one, and I'm really excited to get into this one. So. And that's the kind of game where you do need, I think you do need a pretty solid, like, team to go with, just because, I don't know.
I had a pretty good time playing with randoms. I mean, most people seem to be veterans of the first game and knew what they were doing.
That helps a lot, I think, yeah.
Tribes was definitely full of people that had never played Tribes before.
Yeah.
You know, Nick was saying he'd hopped into one game, and, you know, you played Tribes back in the day, right?
Yeah, I had played
a lot. So you're like, all right, well, I know what's going on, and it's really easy to get a really high score, especially right now when all the noobs are playing it.
Nice. Yeah, well, I was surprised. So, yeah, I just downloaded tonight, and I played one match. And I was surprised, like, how many people weren't really moving. Like, you know, it's
they're just kind of standing around.
Yeah, like, they're just kind of running around and stuff. And it's like, man, you're not playing this game like how you're supposed to play. So, yeah, I ended up getting first place in my first match. Getting the final kill.
he retired.
So I quit the game. I'm
victor of all.
I'm done.
I'm out. Suck it down.
Undefeated.
Nice. Yeah, it's pretty, you know, pretty decent. And then I've been playing Hero Academy with you guys.
So good.
So
it is real fun. I want to start a new game because I want to play my new race.
So is Hero Academy the new Draw Something? Am I behind now?
No, it has a lot more legs, I would say, than Draw Something. Because it's like we've explained it before, and sort of the battle chess, turn-based strategy going on. And I think the guys at Robot Entertainment know what they're doing in terms of sort of drip feeding the content and the new races and updates.
Yeah, it
and there's a lot of personality in that game.
Well, so it's cool. I had found out actually at PAX East that all the artwork in the game is hand drawn by one guy.
Whoa!
He hand paints everything. And then they bring it into the game, so it's pretty cool.
Is this
the little guys have a lot of character to them, and you start off, and it doesn't do a real good job of explaining things, but it does a real good job of like trial and error, basically, of the learning how to play and seeing all the different little things.
Well, I'll just mention that what you learned today about the rewind button.
Yeah, I had no idea that there was an undo to because basically you have a set number of things, actions you can do per turn, and then you do them, and then you submit your turn. Well, I would sometimes fat finger a position of where I want a guy to move or something like that, and it turns out you can actually undo that. So.
Well, I think the nice thing about it is because it's an asynchronous game, and which is like all the best iOS stuff is.
Yeah,
totally.
So you have 5 moves per turn, and you can every time you queue up your moves, you see immediately what the outcome's going to be. You're not blindly doing it. So you run in and you blow up a guy's mage, and then you remove him from the map. And if you don't say you wanted to kill 2 guys instead of 1, you just back out and experiment until the move until you get the optimal result.
Yeah,
that you want.
Yeah, you
and
guys.
The downside
are, you guys
is
are
you
dead
can
now.
You can kind of put yourself into a position where you're going to spend 5 hours on a move because you're trying to explore every optimal.
Yeah. And that's what I mean. I wouldn't mind an option for I don't know if you call it like a hardcore mode where there is a timer. Where you have like a 60-second timer or something, so
yeah,
it would be nice.
So yeah, so that's basically the extent of my gaming, except for programming and playtesting, and yeah, it's really my. So the guy I work on the game with, Dave, he lives in Colorado, but he's home right now in our area for a bit. So we spent probably 30 hours over 2 days just hardcore coding and testing and tweaking, and then we actually had a playtesting party.
Yeah, I saw you
Sunday.
Mentioned that on your Twitter. How was it?
It was cool. It's so different. Like when you're this close to a game and you're working on it and you're just like constantly doing quick iterations and cycling and testing, and you don't really, it's hard to see the big picture sometimes. So the playtesting things are really beneficial for me because I get to sit back and I literally like stand far away from everybody and just watch like facial reactions to things that are happening and just see how they behave in certain situations and stuff. So we got a pretty good grip on how things are working, and I was really happy with the general response. We have a few issues with like communicating information with the player, and then some balancing stuff, because with it being 4 player co-op, that's really difficult for me to kind of test, because we do difficulty scaling and things like that.
Izzy, hold this.
Well, no, seriously, she plays with me a lot. Like she'll be there and just kind of tinker around, but yeah, so it's coming along really well. I already know, like, we want to submit it for Dream Build Play in June. But I already know that there's a couple of things that we're going to add in after that for, we're probably going to adopt the model that everybody's kind of going to now, where you release with your base stuff and then you do incremental updates and kind of keep the content flowing. So we've got a plan for probably 2 or 3 updates after release, for things like achievements and leaderboards, like a arcade style mode, a survival mode, like things like that, that are, they're not difficult to do and stuff, but they'll add some replayability and.
Well, it kind of gives your I guess release a longer tail.
Yeah,
and,
Well, you keep what you do is it's like it's it, you know everything in gaming. It's like you get the spike at release, and then it kind of tails and tails and tails. But so now you can just like kind of keep riding
ride the
that
wave man.
You know, ride the wave.
Buy alternative outfits for head engineer, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Show off those feminine assets.
Yeah, we actually, it's kind of funny is that we might actually toy with having a versus mode in the game. A couple people had some interesting suggestions, and we kind of toyed around some ideas, so we might actually add that down the road too. Kind of But yeah, so that's basically been the bulk of my time. It's nonstop every night.
One question for me is, when is the Firefly skin pack coming out?
Yeah. That would be sweet.
Because yeah, I want, you know, I want the Serenity and brown coats and Force.
That would be super sweet.
So good.
Like, oh my god.
Well, let's move on and let's talk news. Not too much stuff going on. We actually kind of touched on the first thing. It kind of came out of nowhere, but Diablo 3 had an open beta. And
yeah, it was to stress test the game, right?
Yeah, yeah.
As they get ready for release in a couple weeks here.
What's the joke, guys?
I can't do podcasts with Mike anymore.
Don't make eye contact. I can't.
I got IM'd something, so I sent.
Hey,
it
if you
Jason.
If you can't share with the class, it's not can't say it on the podcast.
Well, here you go.
It's no, ice. I don't want
to derail. Let's talk about Diablo 3.
That's what I
want to
talk
burst
about.
Out laughing.
I thought it was funny about Diablo 3.
Okay, but yeah, so it was a surprise to everybody. There was no pre-announcement of it or anything. Blizzard was just like, you know what, we're gonna stress test this crap. And
well, it's kind of their release date announcement, right? I mean, they were just kind of like, you know what, Diablo 3 is coming out. It was like.
Well, I mean, you knew that was coming, but this was kind of a surprise, especially since a couple days prior they had announced the end of the closed beta would be May 1st. So I had actually thought that they were going to keep this open through the end of the beta, but they closed it off today for everybody. So if you didn't get a chance to try it out, you're SOL until release on May 15th. So. But yeah, so that was good news, I guess. That was fun. If you got in, good for you. If not,
yeah, you know, I didn't jump in because you know we'd been in the closed beta for quite a while at this point, and like I don't really want to go through this content one more time until the character is going to stick.
I fired it up like two or three times. Let it update. Started it, got to the menu, and quit because I was like,
Have you guys been doing the sigil stuff on the website?
I did two of them so far.
The unlockable item, or what have you?
Yeah, their website is really nice for the game. There's a ton of stuff on there, and it's like, obviously it's Blizzard, so the artwork and stuff is really gorgeous. But their layout and stuff is just, I don't know, it's a step up from everything else out there.
Yeah, the thing with the way they do websites is they just get one of their dudes to do like an amazing painting and they slap some text over it.
Yeah. all right, let's move on. Talk about some other stuff going on. Payday the Heist. Any of you guys play that?
So good.
Yeah, it was. I played the PC version for a bit and it had some potential. Apparently, it did pretty well because there's going to be a sequel in the works.
Did they get bought out?
They got Starbreeze. Starbreeze.
Yeah,
I thought.
That was the second part of the story. Actually, was nice. That Starbreeze picked them up? Overkill Software is the name of the developer. So that's what really makes this exciting. If Starbreeze kind of adds some of their polish and signature stuff to the game, because it'd be cool. You know, like Starbreeze, I think one of their signature things is that close up interface melee kind of stuff. Like if they add that to the game, like you know, hostage taking with that. Kind of stuff and things like that. It could be pretty cool.
I just want them to add Riddick to it. Why I spent the entire time playing Syndicate. I'm like, this would be so much better if I were Riddick. Just like stealth and shank fools in the back of the neck.
Yeah. So that's some good news. Let's see. I think the last podcast we did talk about Halo 4. We had some info on it. Do you guys remember?
We talked about how there was not going to be firefight and that there was going to be the Spartan Ops mode.
Right,
yeah.
Okay, so in the follow-up to that is, obviously, the internet went ablaze. Oh my god, you're taking away.
Halo.
Yeah.
Co-Optimus nearly went offline.
You know, online petitions of many and everything else, but there's a podcast, it's called the Sparkcast for 343. And they kind of
not hard to say at all.
Yeah, they set things straight basically, and kind of explained some reasons behind it. I didn't actually get to listen to it, but Eric checked it out and kind of wrote up a little article. And basically, it sounds like Spartan Ops is going to be pretty decent, and it's going to be a little bit different than Firefight because it's going to be story-based. And there's going to be content, constant content updates to it. There's cutscenes and things like that. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's...
Well, if you now that we kind of talk about it and know a little bit more about Spartan Ops, I don't know what else they would change on Firefight mode because it was, you know, it's been the same since it came out, and Gears of War did the sort of Horde 2.0, like Firefight 2.0. Where do you go from there? Instead, they're taking this new direction, which is kind of cool. So
what they said is instead of focusing so much on, like, all those modes focus on kills, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what ends up happening is a co-opetition kind of a thing where people are, you know, comparing scores and things like that, which is fine. You know, that has its place. But what they said that they wanted to do was create more objective-based gameplay kind of stuff. So you just focus on teamwork. Yeah. So we'll see. You know, we'll see how it works out. I don't know if the last little piece of news with this. I don't know if you guys saw the Conan O'Brien bit.
That video he did.
Yeah, no, it's really awkward.
Yeah, it's kind of. I don't understand it.
It's weird. I didn't see it, but there was a release date.
Right. Yes. You're right. I forgot.
I think Obama's going to lose the election because the youth of America are going to be rushing out to buy Halo instead of voting.
Yeah, so as Mike said, it's November 6th, which is Election Day in the United States.
So do your civic duty and then go pick up the game.
Do your civic duty and then teabag that booty.
That's the one.
Wow.
That's the one.
You can have that.
Yeah, that goes on the back of the box.
The people I want voting are the people who play Halo.
No, they can't even vote on a map.
Oh,
and we out.
That's it. Drop the mic.
All right. Let's move on.
Too many bad memories playing shoddy snipers in Halo 3.
Yep.
Our last little bit of news for the week or 2 weeks is there's a new Super Mario Brothers in the works, and it'll be unveiled at E3 this year. It'll be a Wii U game, and hopefully they'll fix the crappy co-op that was in the first one.
And again, I'll play it without co-op and have a much better time.
There was
no. It's a party game.
What video was I watching recently? Oh, the Mega 64 guys have that indie man. I can't think of the character name, and he kind of made fun of the whole Mario Brothers thing and how everybody runs into each other and gets knocked off ledges and how annoying it was, and so hopefully they'll fix that.
Did you see their latest one? They did a Zelda one.
No, I did not.
For Skyward Sword.
Oh man.
It's incredibly awkward.
Those guys are
incredibly awkward.
Yeah, but I mean that's their shtick though, is just to, you know.
Oh yeah, they're fun dudes. It's just incredibly awkward.
Yeah.
I don't think they're ever gonna top the Heavy Rain one. I stopped watching after them. Like, they cannot do any better than this.
All right.
But yeah, so that's it for news. Kind of light news going on. It's April's been a pretty light month. Not too much in the way of releases. Not too much news. But everything's gearing up for E3, which is in about 6 weeks now, 7 weeks, which is crazy. I actually scheduled some appointments today. EA was scheduling appointments already, and it's like, holy crap.
Jeez.
But now we're at our feature section of the podcast, and there's a new story that came out today. And this is something we've kind of been talking about this on the past couple of podcasts, and... it just keeps coming up and keeps coming back. And I think, you know, Mike actually reinforced it with what he's been playing. And we're talking free to play and how it's kind of changing the gaming industry in terms of what developers are putting, or, you know, where they're putting their resources and what they're trying. And there's a big shakeup. And so the story is from Splash Damage, who created Brink. And they said that they sold 2.5 million copies of the game, which equates to, you know, a couple $100 million in actual revenue, of which they saw. You know, the thing is, the quote says if they sold 2.5 million at retail cost, but you got to figure in like Steam sales and all that other stuff. So The end result, though, what they were trying to get the point across was they didn't see anywhere near that amount of money because everybody has their hand in the cookie jar kind of a thing, right? So what they've done, and it's kind of interesting how they're doing this, is they split their studio into three. And they have a team that's solely focused working on, like, services. And so this team's going to be, like, creating, like, multiplayer kind of – we're talking, like, technology services and things like that. Not only will it be integrated in their games, but also they'll be selling that. So that's one form of revenue they'll be pulling in. And then there's another team that's going to be focused on, like, free-to-play style games. And again, utilizing those services that they built. And then all of those are going to be funding their AAA, quote-unquote, splash damage team, which is, you know, I guess going to go... you know, they didn't really say if they're going to self-publish or what, but... it sounds like they don't want to take a lot of publisher money to make their bigger games. So that's their idea behind some of these other smaller ones.
That's interesting, but that they're taking that approach, just because that seems like a lot of manpower to have three separate teams to do that.
Well, it's good because, one, you're not putting all your eggs in one basket, right? Because traditionally you have these studios that are one project focused, yeah, right? And because of that, and because of the way the projects work, there's downtimes and stuff for people. And this is the thing that keeps coming up for, like, you know, day one DLC and all that stuff. Like, what people don't understand is, like, not everybody is 100% active on game development at any time, because their role in it might be over or might be very limited. They might be doing a fix a week or something like that, as opposed to someone that's, like, doing coding and doing bug testing and things like that. So it's kind of smart to spread the wealth.
Yeah. And usually, I mean, studios do have those people in place already, so the fact that they're splitting them up into three distinct things really doesn't, I mean, I think it's just telling them to focus on...
Right, exactly, yeah. I mean, it's just putting a name to something.
Right.
And kind of giving structure to things. But so the discussion, you know, the discussion we want to have is basically, what is free-to-play doing to the gaming market? You know, how is it changing it? How are things, like, everyone says, oh, you got the, you know, the iPad and iOS and mobile gaming and stuff, and how that's going to take over and stuff like that. You know, what exactly is its role in all of this, and how is it changing these things? I think Splash Damage is a good studio to look at. I think Robot Entertainment maybe kind of following what those guys have done, coming from Ensemble Studios, working at Microsoft, and, you know, Age of Empires series, and then Halo Wars, and splitting off, and then kind of doing a digital release, and then, you know, testing the water with their, you know, we talked about Hero Academy, stuff like that, and they're still, you know, that's helping fund and do things like Works Must Die 2 and whatever else they're working on.
I think I've paid more for Hero Academy than I did for Works Must Die 1. I spent $8 on Hero Academy, and I think Orcs Must Die was like $3 when I picked it up. So,
but
which
so,
I don't, yeah.
So I was just gonna say, I know I briefly kind of mentioned it, that coming back from PAX East, it was very apparent and in your face that free to play is a huge part of the gaming market now. It was 50% of that show. You know, you had things like the World of Tanks folks, you had League of Legends, you had. Firefall. Yeah, you know, I mean, some just huge, they're biggest booths of the show, and they were crowded, and people love this stuff, and everyone's trying to kind of experiment and seeing where it's going to go, and it's funny that, you know, the free-to-play moniker, it's basically what I think developers have done, and we've heard this quote before, is that, like, it's expensive to make demos of games, right? And a lot of times when you make the demo, it's not indicative of what the actual experience is like. And so what they're essentially doing now is making the entire game the demo and then offering up the content to, you know, additional fluffy content to make things kind of stick. So
it's an interesting way to do it. And I haven't played a ton of free-to-play stuff, but I am more willing to give them money if it's free to play. Like, if I buy into, let's say Super Monday Night Combat, $15 up front, I'm probably gonna, you know, play it for a while. If I really enjoy it, yeah, maybe I'll give them some cash. But for the people that it doesn't resonate with and doesn't click with, they're like, well, I spent $15, I got a couple matches in, they throw it aside. But if you're able to sort of make it accessible for everyone and just open the floodgates of users, you get that huge install base right up front, and it's like, you just use that word of mouth being like, yeah, free to play, come play right now with me, and you get four friends, right? So
What's interesting is I used to think that, and I had heard numbers a long time ago, that it was like the few pays for the many in the free-to-play model, right? It was like the top 15% of those users are the ones that are driving most of the revenue for the developers. But it was actually, I think it was today or yesterday, I saw an article that came out.
Today it was the 40%.
Yeah, 40% of people have paid money in free-to-play games.
Oh, cool.
So that number is definitely going up. I mean, you still have the crazy things. Like, there's certain games where you have, like, really limited items that are, like, $200, $300, right? And you only have, like, 10 available or whatever. And people pay it, right? People want to be that standout.
And if that's whatever. Your game, like, you're doing that.
Yeah. But, yeah, so yeah, like Mike said, it's up to 40% now people are paying money in the free-to-play game. So... And because of that growth, I mean, something's working. Something's resonating with users, and people are starting to get it. I mean, in North America, it's kind of new. It's still catching on, and it's changing from the Asian model, which has been around for maybe 10
forever.
Years or so, right? Yeah. You know, it's been around a lot longer.
I think it's a question of perceived value now. Like, before, you'd get into a free-to-play game, and... it would be a pay-to-win scenario, right? So,
and that's definitely
I want to be good at this game, but without shelling out $200 in random tchotchkes, I'm not going to be competitive. But now, you know, that you get invested in the game because almost everything is available to you, you know, out the gate, and the stuff that you can buy is like better character customization. Access to higher tier perks, so you don't spend like in tribes. As you know, there's some stuff like you earn about 800 experience per match if you do like the deathmatch mode. And there's some stuff that costs about 1,000 experience to unlock all the really early stuff. So you do a couple matches, you start getting unlocks right away. But like all the really cool stuff is start getting into like 50,000 to 75,000. And so you either play 75 matches and do well to score 1,000 points, or you drop 99 cents.
Like a grown-ass adult.
Yeah. It's like, I have only so much time to give, and I really only want this one thing, but I don't want to put in that much time to get it. So they dangle that carrot out there really effectively, and, you know, it's... I think a lot of it is it ties into the number of times that people buy random shit off of a Steam sale. It's like this game's $60. I don't know about that, but when that game is $5,
I will try anything.
Number of games I have in my Steam list that have about 30 minutes of playtime that I got for $2 to $5 is pretty high.
Well, that's I will play this solitaire RPG variant for $5.
So what's better, selling, you know, 400,000 copies at $60 a piece, or having 20 million people play your game and drop 99 cents to $2?
Yeah. Well, that's just it, too, is that the whole Steam sale and everything like that, and the payment, there was an article in the Penny Arcade Report about, you know, how, and it's varying sides of things, how Steam sales and indie bundle sales actually increase the value of games, and then there was an opposing article saying actually they devalue. But in the Penny Arcade Report article, Mike Ambrosi from Final Form Games, our favorite little group of Jamestown developers, was talking about how when they did their sales on Steam, the very first sale that they did, which I remember Mike and I were there for when they got this.
Yeah, we were actually there when it was going on.
They got three times as many sales, you know, like copies purchased as they had, you know, in terms of all purchases to that date. And then it just increased and increased and increased.
So it's money they didn't have before, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's the free-to-play model follows along kind of the same mentality, is that we, you know, for $5, we'll pick up a game and play it because it's $5. And we heard, it's all right. Or we heard that it's a new take on the solitaire... RPG, whatever it was that you said, with diamonds.
You know, I actually think the
free to play model is, we're all grown ass adults and we don't have time because there's a million games out there. So if I just drop 99 cents, I can get what I want and be done with this.
Yeah.
I also think that that free to play model is a really effective way at reducing at least the perceived effects of privacy or piracy on your game.
Yeah.
Because if bro's gonna download it, he's gonna download it anyway, regardless of whether you can do it. But the free to play model gives a means to monetize any user. You know, I download a copy of, you know, Saints Row 3 and pirate it. They're not getting a red cent out of me. I have the game. I'm going to play it. But if it was free to play and I played it, but there was an in-game mechanism for me to drop in a credit card and, you know, buy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's potentially giving me an avenue to give them money that they didn't get before. So, you know, I see it being very successful, and especially now, like, you know, how Tribes and Super Monday Night Combat have really high production values.
Yeah.
You know, those are, you know, big release looking games, and they're free.
Yeah.
So do you guys think, this is an interesting thing to possibly consider, I think it was the original Modern Warfare that kind of created that model of multiplayer where there's tiers and unlocks and things and things. Stuff like that. And that's essentially what a lot of the free-to-play games kind of adopted to, you know...
I think Battlefield 2 did that first, right?
Uh-oh.
Well, no, not the... Well,
did Call of Duty versus Battlefield, the war continues.
this is where we've degenerated.
My question...
Well, still, I see where you're going.
Do you think that kind of drove the adoption here? Like, they're like, well, we can make the North American developers like, well, we can make a free-to-play thing based on that, and everyone saw that as acceptable. Before that point, it was like, well, no, I'm not doing that. It was, you know, I have to pay $20 for this gun and a pack of bullets for it or whatever. You know, did some seriously, there were games that were like that. They were that crazy and hardcore.
And in something like Call of Duty, you know, the player that's, you know, hit level 55 or whatever and has the red dot sight attachment for all the most powerful guns in the game always had a huge advantage over, you know, the person who just got the game. If you didn't get that game on launch day, you were screwed because everyone was already better than you, regardless of their actual skill. And the free-to-play model, at least, you know, going down that road, allows someone to be competitive very quickly.
Yeah.
And if it's done right, they'll be competitive, you know, without having to buy anything. It'll just make their life a little easier.
It also, you know, you kind of also brought a point is that while the older game or, you know, like Call of Duty, whatever else, if you don't get it on launch day, you kind of fall behind. The free-to-play games seem to have more a constant flow of users coming in. So there's always new users and there's always groups that you're kind of, you know, flowing in with and leveling up with and going along with.
Yeah, because until you've put money into the ecosystem, you're not financially tied to the game, so there's a natural ebb and flow that doesn't exist elsewhere, I think.
So go ahead, man.
I was just going to say, I really like that because I honestly don't have those, you know, tens, hundreds of hours to invest into these games to get good anymore, so it is nice to be able to hop in and hop out without that pressure of... It's like, if I fall behind and I don't have, you know, all these unlocks, I can, you know, maybe pay $5, grab a couple perks I need, and then continue on my way.
So what about for co-op games, then, in terms of going free-to-play to tie it back to, I don't know, our site or whatever? The idea that if you're going to do free-to-play and it's not something where it's like Monday Night Combat or Tribes, which is typically very multiplayer focused, for as a lot of these games kind of are, because it's that pressure to be better than the guy next to you.
Well, I'd say Firefall is a good example of what they're doing with some of their stuff, at least from what they're saying. So you'll be able to buy things like, you know, if you form a co-op group and you form, I forget what they call their clans, basically, but you can basically form a clan and then you can buy customizations for your clan. So in that case, you know, everybody can kind of dress the same or take benefits. They get benefits from what the clan buys and things like that. Like they said that, like, the, you know, the top level can buy stuff, and then everybody else in that group can actually pull from it.
It's like monetizing guild functions in MMO. I think for co-op stuff, MMOs are pretty much, you know, where it's at as far as free-to-play stuff right now. And, you know, those games are inherently, you know, some of them are all but forced co-op. Like, you'll hit that brick wall, at least in the pre-WoW model, where you actually can't go on without playing with other people.
And there are, you know, when you look at League of Legends, has co-op in it, right? I mean, it's essentially comp stomp, but I mean, it's not the kind of game that has a story or anything like that anyway. So the MOBA games are definitely co-op focused. You know, I just sent Mike and Locke today the Dota 2 codes. Check that out as well.
That's so bad.
we're gonna be called the worst names ever. You do realize that, right?
I don't care.
He's heard them all. He's from Canada.
Those words mean nothing to me. I'm Canadian.
I'll just apologize.
there has been some shooters that have added a co-op mode to it that are free to play. There's that combat arms game, which kind of followed. It was more of a hybrid of the old kind of Asian model mixed with a newer model. You know, it wasn't very good.
Buy them bullets.
But it was a start. What about something like free-to-play co-op platformers or...
Well, there's...
Maple Story.
Oh, no, that's...
Is it Wakfu? What is that Wakfu? It's not a platformer, it's like a...
It's a little bit of a isometric RPG. Yeah. Like, it's not quite a platformer, a little bit more Secret of Mana-esque, yeah.
Yeah. Dungeon Fighter Online.
I'm really excited about. I mean, and that's interesting too, because it made the transition from PC free to play now to going to the Xbox.
Yeah.
And Microsoft is very much about, well, you gotta pay for everything.
You gotta pay for something, yeah.
Yeah. So all right, so the final question I think this this discussion is really in you know, a year or 2 years, think we're going to see some bigger AAA style. Like, Splash Damage is a pretty big studio, and they've got a lot of stuff under their belt. For them to be saying that they're going to be shifting to kind of this hybrid model of doing stuff, do you think we'll see Activision maybe coming out with a free-to-play game, or EA? I mean, yeah, I guess EA has already got a bunch, right? But there's just more.
I have a prediction.
Okay.
I have a bold prediction.
Oh, okay. Throw it out there.
Epic's Fortnite will be free-to-play.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think absolutely, Nick. I think absolutely we're going to see more and more.
No one agrees with my prediction.
I don't even know what that is.
Wouldn't, no.
Yeah.
It on the surface, it looks like almost it would be. It's already going to be one of those kind of games.
I'll tell you my opinion in 2 weeks. How about that?
When we know.
No,
in a fortnight.
Yeah.
I am cutting off your mic, I swear.
There's the game that, I mean, it's not Epic US, but the Epic Games China, that the game that I had posted on today, which now the name is eluding me. They haven't talked about if it's a free-to-play game or not, but it appears to me like it's going to be. Hold on, almost there. Where are you? Mercenary Ops.
Yeah,
which it's going to have an 8-player co-op mode and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean it's still a pretty big developer. It's a wing of that developer that's doing it. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. It'll see. You know, all this stuff is basically PC at this point, right?
Right.
So you know, you sent Dungeon Fighter Online. It's supposedly coming to Xbox. And it's going to be free to play.
Supposedly.
Right. Let's.
One Microsoft point.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens with that and if it takes off. But I think I could see it next generation of the consoles and stuff.
But here's what I'm curious about too.
Having a dedicated corner for that kind of stuff.
Didn't Sony just put out a free-to-play puzzle game?
They had the Montezuma Blitz game. Yeah, it's free, you can download. I don't know what the purchasable stuff in it is, but...
Well, there was just like a Match 3 game, too.
Oh.
I'm excited. I saw it. No, really, though, here's
one
kind of...
Was it a solitaire RPG?
Dude, you stay away from those. Those are good. No,
the queen is on a quest.
I think they probably could have released the Mass Effect 3 co-op mode and made that its separate entity, free to play, and it would make tons of money off those packs. Like,
that's a good example of how it would work on a console.
Like, I guarantee they have made way more money than they expected off those packs, and I think that they will seriously take that into consideration.
Actually, here's the question is, do they at all? Does Microsoft pay them for any of their Space Bucks points? Because you're paying Microsoft, and so the microtransactions, how does that actually work through them?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I mean, EA's been doing that stuff for years, though. You play, you know, Nick and I play Tiger Woods, and you can, like, every unlock in that game, you can unlock with MS points.
Right, yeah.
You know, and that is essentially the free-to-play model. You can grind the money in the game to get it, or you can drop 99 cents and unlock it.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was this past year, somebody figured it out, and it was like, you bought the $60 Tiger Woods game, and then you bought and unlocked all the stuff at launch, you would be paying like $260 or something.
Oh, man.
Essentially.
Yeah.
So and you crazy. Know what? There was people that did it.
They did.
You know,
yeah.
There was.
Yeah. The addendum kind of to all this question in terms of next year, do we see more free-to-plays from AAAs is it perceived at all that a AAA company that makes a game free-to-play, the game is a failure? So Brink now shifting from, they said, yeah, we sold 2.5 million where it's the money on it, so we're going to a free-to-play model. Is that seen as a failure of the game, a failure of the company? What is it?
I don't know, but I think almost every game you see coming out of Valve in the future is going to have some kind of free-to-play component. I mean, will eventually become free.
They can hook my credit card up to their freaking system if I get Half-Life 3, but, you know, that's beside the point.
Well, I mean, Team Fortress 2 is free. Dota 2 is going to be free. I'm sure you'll have to pay for Half-Life, but...
That's a little different. You can't really have it with a story-driven game. It's more a multiplayer thing, I find.
Give them money to buy new glasses for Gordon Freeman.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I want the Gordon Freeman voice pack. How many of those do you think they could sell?
Oh, jeez.
Here's what the British sound when they're silent.
But, so. On a side note, just one, the Humble bundle right now, the Botanicula, I think that's the name of it, is really good and everyone should buy it.
Okay.
It's wicked.
Buy me some time to play all these games, Locke.
Yeah.
Okay, give me 99 cents and I'll give you 5 minutes.
Let's wrap things up. We had some great discussion, I think, on today's podcast, but we're sadly at the end.
Oh,
yeah,
it's
the
worst part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
The time has come again.
Do some housekeeping. We have an iOS app now for your iPhones, your iPads, your iPods.
Crazy.
So download that. Give us awesome ratings on it. Windows Phone 7 app, Android app, those are also available. We still have a couple t-shirts left at Split Reason, splitreason.com/cooptimus. You can, I don't know, there's, I think it's just our logo shirt and maybe some of the coin op shirts left at this point. If you're listening to us on iTunes, please give us some awesome ratings, thumbs up, say we're sexy, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, and, seriously. Why do you think I'm on here?
Yeah. To up the sexiness.
Cheesecake.
And we're also on Twitter. We are Co-Optimus without the dash. You can leave us a voicemail, 646-926-6748. And that is that. Gentlemen, I thank you for your time and your thoughts, your brains, and love.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting us into your mind palace.
Wait, what did I just agree to?
All right. Have a good one.
Peace.